December the 18th, we're in Shmuel, and we're about to start Perek Chaf Aleph. But before we start, we have to tie up one last piece from last time. And that is, we were discussing that Shaul referred to Yonasan as Ben Na'avas HaMardus. And we discussed last time that the reason why he referred to him as that, which is the rebellious son of the wayward woman. Mm-hmm. So the reason why he referred to him as that is because we mentioned last time that when the tribe of Binyamin was nearly decimated, and Shaul was one of the only ones left, and they had made because of the civil war within Klal Yisrael, because of the story of Pilegesh Begiva, the Jews had made and taken an oath that they would not marry their daughters to the people from Binyamin. So even though the civil war was now over and there were very few people from Binyamin left, there was no one to marry them because of this oath. And they found one group of women that were not subject to the oath. Again, that whole story of why that's so, separate discussion. And the women congregated in one particular place, and the men came there, and there was there were many matches made. Shaul did not. He felt embarrassed to do that. Shaul, with his modesty, and he would not go seek out the women. And Shaul's wife had to actually seek him out, and that's why he refers to Yonasan as the son of this. Remember the English translation?
In my book, it says the son of perverse rebellion.
Yeah, perverse rebellion, right. That she didn't act with modesty, that she came to me. So it would seem that Shaul was degrading Yonasan, saying something negative towards him. But it's difficult to say that because, first of all, why would he do that? Why would he just put him down? I mean, I understand he's upset with him, but it's the insult that he's using is insulting his own wife. And Yonasan's also his son. So what exactly is he saying over here? So it should be noted that we discussed this somewhat when we learned Megillas Rus. And we pointed out that the interesting thing about Malchus, about royalty, is that the line of David HaMelech, of King David, is one that is the most important line. It's the most important lineage that we have. Torah does not require a lineage. Torah requires a transmission from Rebbe to Talmud, from teacher to student. But it does not require a lineage. You don't have to be related in order to become a Talmud Chacham, to become a great scholar, and to wear the crown of Torah. It's not required that there be a lineage. In fact, it specifically is not a family-based thing. The two lines that are required is Kuhuna, is that of the priesthood, which comes from Aaron, and that of Malchus, of David. But the one of David is more specific because there is only one line. With Kuhuna, there are many different Kohanim, even though they all come from Aaron, but there's a lot of Kohanim, and the lineage goes on. They have requirements, they have more stringent requirements about who they're allowed to marry, who they're not allowed to marry, but that line goes on, and it is important. But it is not as critical as the line of David HaMelech. David HaMelech's line is the line that eventually produces Mashiach. Now, we showed when we learned Megillas Rus that that line, several times throughout history, was in danger of being eradicated. It was in danger in the time of Yehuda, with Tamar, with Er and Onan being killed, and there only being one son left, Shelah, and from Yehuda's perspective, there was really no one to marry him, no one appropriate to marry him. It was in danger of being wiped out, even with Lot and his daughters, that there was nothing, almost nothing left of Lot. And we know that the mother, the Ima Shalmachus, the mother of royalty, comes from Lot. It was in danger of being wiped out in the time of Rus. That at that time there was there were many potential people to carry on that line from going from Yehuda down to David, but it was precariously on the verge of being wiped out with the story of Boaz and Rus. And it happens again later on in history. After David's line has been established, there'll be a point where everybody will be wiped out except for one. We'll see that later on, Mitzvah Hashem, in Sefer Malachim. So it happens many times. We don't know how many other times it's happened, but the line is not a simple line. Because it is a line that is based on parents, children, and then those children growing up and having children, etc., then the whole process of one person producing another person producing another person is the area in which the Satan, the Yetzer Hara, attacks this line and attempts to undermine it. And the way it attempts to undermine it is either by physically wiping them out, that's one way, and the other way is by trying to introduce impurities, by trying to make the line impure, to make it not according to the Torah. That was what some thought was happening in the time of Rus, that there was a woman being introduced into the line that didn't belong there and would make the line impure, improper. We know that because of the rules of tzniut, of modesty, the appropriate manner for men and women, let me take a step back, the whole institution of marriage, which is the interface between men and women, is in itself, has to be handled in a way that does not compromise tzniut, that doesn't compromise modesty. Here you have an interesting thing that Hashem has put into creation, in that, generally speaking, men and women are not to interact in a social manner. That generally speaking, there need to be significant fences between the genders. But when it comes to marriage, there we want two people of opposite genders to join together, and in fact, to actually become as one and create a family. And that is the exact opposite. And it has to be handled delicately in whatever time frame you find yourself in, and whatever culture you find yourself in. The process of having men and women be able to marry has to be tempered by the threat to modesty. And this has been an age-old issue of how to go about setting up men and women. We know that the way Abraham did it was he sent Eliezer to find a wife for Yitzchak. He didn't even send Yitzchak himself. Yaakov found a wife on his own. He went and was there and found a wife on his own. We have different methods throughout history, starting in the Chumash itself and in the Nevi'im, and up to modern times, and it's an age-old thing. Exactly what's the exact balance in how to do this. There was at one point, this goes back already, probably to the 80s, the early 80s, where because of the rise in the divorce rate within the frum community, within the Orthodox community, at that time, there were those who tried to suggest methods to prevent that. So one of the great leaders of the non-Hasidic community, of the yeshivish community, said that he felt that the young men and young women were getting married without dating long enough, and that was leading to marriages that really shouldn't have happened. And therefore, he suggested that there be at least 8 dates before an engagement. That was the way it was said. So allegedly, I say allegedly because I didn't hear this firsthand, but allegedly the Satmar Rebbe, who was known for his sharp rejoinders, said the Hasidic community has always been much more careful in this area and much less willing to allow mingling of that sort. And so he quoted the pasuk in Parshas Toldos where Rivka says to Yitzchak, in order to have Yitzchak send Yaakov away to find a wife, so she says that that the wives of Esav were unacceptable to her because they were idolaters. So she says to Yitzchak, "Katzi bechayai, I am disgusted with in my life. Mipnei, because of Benos, the daughters of Ches, because they were from the nation Ches, the Chittim. That's where they were from. So she says, I'm disgusted by these women of Ches. So he said, "Katzi bechayai, I am appalled or disgusted. Mipnei Benos Ches." Ches is the letter Ches, which is eight, which is the number eight. He said, I am appalled by this idea of going out eight times. So even within the same time and in the same country, there can be different approaches for what's appropriate and inappropriate. But it is a matter which people have to think about. You can't just have a free-for-all. There's got to be a system. Otherwise, you end up with a problem with tznius. As part of that process, it is considered to be appropriate. This is true in the secular world, certainly up until modern times, but even in modern times, the truth is, this is the more common thing. And it is considered to be appropriate and quote-unquote normal for the man to seek out the woman. And even in modern times, where the gender differences have become blurred, but even so, many women will prefer that to see that the man who's interested in them is actually seeking them out instead of the other way around. And in terms of tznius, that's certainly appropriate, that it be the man who is the one who is seeking and the woman is the one being sought, as opposed to the other way around. We find, therefore, in the line of David HaMelech, of King David, that in the attack on that line, one of the ways that it is attacked is that situations are set up where it is the only way it can be continued is for the woman to seek out the man, which is a reversal of the proper tznius way of handling things. That's why my Rosh Hashiva of Weinberg's on Arach of Blessed Memory said that that's why you find that Lot's daughters initiated with Lot, which was the reverse of what is normal. And you find that it is Naomi who orchestrates that Rus should initiate with Boaz. Mm-hmm. And that's why you find that Tamar is the one who initiates with Yehuda. All these are not along the, what we would call normal path. They're not prohibited. There's nothing inherently, there's nothing absolutely bad about them, but they are what we would call a little bit strange. And this is one of the ways that the line of David HaMelech is threatened, that when you have something like that, it can be easily done wrong. Now, in those three cases, it worked out fine. We haven't gotten yet to the story of David and Bathsheba. Mm-hmm. When we get to that story, we will see that what went wrong over there was along these lines, that the way that one sought the other was inappropriate, as we will see. But it was because of this very fine, subtle way of doing things. Shaul says to Yonah's son, you are the product of a situation where your mother sought out your father rather than the other way around. Your mother sought me out rather than me seeking out your mother. It seems to me that what Shaul is saying to Yonasan is, you believe that David should be the king and not you. You are also a product of a reversal of the way things normally work, which is a hallmark of the way that David HaMelech's line was created and goes on. It's a reversal that does not cross a line in a bad way. It's a reversal, it's not normal, but it is still within the appropriate boundaries. Nothing was done bad when your mother came to me and sought me out. It wasn't bad. It wasn't wrong. It was abnormal. It wasn't according to the normal way that tznius works, but no line was crossed. That is an indication that you are the product of something that should be within the line of royalty. It seems to me that what Shaul was saying to Yonasan is one of the proofs that you really are supposed to be in the royal line is that you are the son of the woman who sought out the husband but did it in a way that didn't cross any boundaries inappropriately, just as we find with David HaMelech's line. So I don't think he was putting him down. I think he was saying to him, why are you rejecting the throne? Just the opposite. Your lineage is such that would suggest you do belong on the throne, just as we find with David HaMelech.
What does that word Navas mean?
I'm not exactly sure how to translate that. Rashi, what's that?
Disgusting, no?
Rashi says over there that it's a language of a woman. Rashi says a woman who goes out, like from Nava Nud.
Oh, okay.
That's what
wanders, kind of.
Wanders, yeah. Yeah.
Okay,
so that is Perakof. That's what we left off at chapter 20. Now we begin Perakof Aleph, chapter 21. So we finally now have a situation where David knows he must run away. They've tested the waters. Yonasan went to Shaul, discovered that he does want to kill David. They shot the arrows to see whether Hashem wants David to leave, and Hashem made it clear that yes, David should leave. So he's already tried to run away to his home. That didn't work. Then he tried to run away to Shmuel. That didn't work. Then he went to Yonasan and hid in the field, and they tested the waters, and that didn't work. So now he needs to run away. The question is, where exactly is David going to run? Where should he go? Remember, he's in Israel, which is the country that is ruled by Shaul, and Shaul wants to kill him. Where should David go? It's not an easy question to answer. Where should he go? If he stays in the country, what prevents Shaul from tracking him down? Shaul has all the resources of the country at his disposal. He has the army. He has loyal subjects. Where is David going to hide? That's one. If he leaves the country, where is he going to go? We'll see later where he has to go. But I'm saying, where is he supposed to go that would be a safe haven for David? David, who has been the general of Shaul and has led the wars, where should he go? It's not a simple thing to answer. But there's a more immediate problem for David, and that is that he's been hiding for 3 days, and he has been without food, and now he needs to run away. So what does he do? So he needs to go to a place where he can get safe haven, at least temporarily. But there is a danger in going anywhere. First of all, going anywhere where they may betray him to Shaul is a problem. That's not necessarily a big problem yet, because the country has not yet been informed that David has a price on his head. Shaul's closest confidants know about it, but it has not yet become this public thing with posters all over the country saying dead or alive. Mm-hmm. That hasn't happened yet. But there is the danger that whoever David goes to seek help from will unwittingly be aiding and abetting a criminal, at least a criminal in the eyes of the state. And maybe they would be guilty by association. So David has to be careful. Where should he go for help without causing problem for the people who help him. So the Navi tells us, Vayakam Vayelach, he got up and he went. The Yehonasan Bahir, Yehonasan went back to the city. Vayavo David Nove, David came to Nov. Al Achimelech HaKohen to Achimelech the Kohen. Vayacharan Achimelech Likras David. Achimelech trembled to greet David. Vayomer, when he said to him, Madua Ata Levadech, why are you by yourself? V'ish Eini Tach, and there's no one with you. So David goes to Nov. Nov, the city of the Kohanim. What does it mean that it was the city of the Kohanim? What does that mean?
That's where they escaped because somebody wanted to kill them.
That's where?
They escaped to that place.
From where?
From Yerushalayim because they wanted to be killed. No? Someone wanted to kill them.
Well, the Kohanim used to be... The Kohanim... You mean, that's where David escaped to. Yes. Right. But what does it mean? The Kohanim is at the city of the Kohanim.
Was the Mishkanim?
So the Mizbeach was now in Nov. No. The Mizbeach had been... The altar had been in Shiloh. Shiloh was destroyed in the days of Eli and Shmuel. And now the new place for the Mizbeach was Nov. Nov was on the outskirts of Yerushalayim. It was a town not far from Yerushalayim. From Nov, you could see Yerushalayim. So that is where the Mizbeach was, and that's where David goes. Now, why does he choose to go to Nov? He doesn't feel safe going back to his house, to Michal. He's aware that the guards are going to be looking for him there. So he runs to Nov. So why Nov?
Probably wants to find a way he should run. He needs food.
Well, he needs food. He needs help. So why does he choose Nov as a place to go for help?
Because he can trust them.
Okay, he can trust them. He can trust them. Now they don't know that he is that he's a fugitive. Here, Achimelech says to David, "Why are you by yourself? There's no one with you. What's going on?" Achimelech realizes right away there's something strange over here. David, who is of the highest government officials, and he's all by himself. That doesn't make any sense. David always has an entourage. Where is his entourage? So Achimelech is unaware that David is a fugitive. But David goes to Achimelech for help. Now he's going to make up a story. He says, "Why are you by yourself?" Vayomer David l'Achimelech. David says to Achimelech HaKohen, "Hamelech tzivani davar." The king commanded me a thing. Vayomer lai said to me, "Ish al yeda me'uma." No man should know anything. Es ha'davar ashanochi sholechacha. The thing that I'm sending you for. Vasher tzivisicha, which I commanded you. So David says, "I'm on a top secret mission. I can't tell you." What about my entourage? And the Na'arim, the lads who were with me, I sent them to a place of such and such. I can't tell you where I sent them. If I tell you, I have to kill you. Right? He says, I'm not going to tell you where I'm sending. I can't tell you. It's top secret. But I sent them off to take care of where they had to take care of. And now that's why I'm by myself. So Achimelech does not know that this is a made-up story. And David tells a made-up story. Now, clearly David doesn't want to tell Achimelech the truth. Why would he not tell Achimelech the truth?
Puts him in danger.
Puts who in danger?
Achimelech.
It puts Achimelech in danger. Better he shouldn't know. He's more protected if he doesn't know, because then he can honestly say, "I had no idea." Mm-hmm. That's number one. Number two, of all the cities that he would go to for help, which is the one that Shaul is most likely to believe when they claim that they had no idea that David was a fugitive?
The Kohanim.
The Kohanim. The Kohanim have credibility. They have credibility. They are it's a city of those who work within the Mizbeach. It is people who are not from Shevet Yehuda that they would be, that they would harbor their own. David is not a Kohen. And they are not from Yehuda, so they have no vested interest in particularly protecting David over Shaul, and they are a special group, and therefore it would be most likely that Shaul would give them the benefit of the doubt. So that's where he goes to for help. And so he runs there, and now he says, he needs two things from them. He says, first of all, now what do you have under your hand? If you have five loaves, put them in my hands. Oh, or whatever you've got. I need to eat. The Gemara tells us that David was achzaso bulmos, which means that he was in a very dangerous situation for lack of eating. He felt extremely weak and realized that if he did not eat soon, that he would be his life was in danger. He needed to eat now. Vayana Kohen es David. So the Kohen answered David. Vayomer, he said, Ein lechem chol el tachas yadi. I have no regular bread under my hands. Ki im lechem kodesh, only sanctified bread yesh I have. Im nishmu anarim ach meisha. As long as the na'arim, the lads, have been careful from a woman. Meaning, I have bread, but the bread is not regular bread. This is sanctified bread. This is bread of Kedusha of the Beis HaMikdash. Now, bread of that stature cannot be eaten by somebody who is Tameh. And when a husband and wife are intimate, they both become Tameh. And so if any of the lads, because Achimelech believes that David is going to take this bread for not just himself, but for his lads as well, if any of the lads have been in contact with their wives recently, then they cannot eat this bread. Vayan David es ha-kohen, David answered the kohen, Vayomer lo, he said to him, Ki im isha atzura lanu kismol shel shom, a woman has been off limits to us from yesterday and from the day before. We've all been away from our wives. Vitsesi, when I left. Vayu chlei ha-na'arim kodesh, so all the utensils and the clothing of the lads are sanctified, which means nobody is tamei and their clothing is not tamei. Vuhu derechol, and the bread you're talking about is actually sort of not sanctified. It's sort of chol. Va'av ki ayom yikdash bakeli, even if today it would be sanctified in the utensil, I would take it anyway. Now what this means, the Gemara explains as follows. The bread, what bread did the Kohen have in the Beis HaMikdash?
Matzah.
Well, that's true. It was all matzah. It's true. What we call bread in the Beis HaMikdash was all matzah. Not the brittle matzah we're talking about. It's a little bit of a thicker matzah, but it was matzah. But it was the lechem hapanim. It was the show bread. That's what there was. And the lechem hapanim is an interesting type of institution in the Beis HaMikdash. The way that most things work in the Beis HaMikdash is that you have an item, and that item either gets completely burned on the Mizbeach, on the altar, and it is not eaten by human beings at all, or part of it is burned, and part of it is eaten. So, for instance, a Karban Ola, a complete burnt offering, the entire offering is burned. Nobody eats any of it. A Karban Chatas, a sin offering, part of it is burned, and part of it is eaten by the Kohanim. A Karban Shlamim, a peace offering, part of it is burned, part of it is eaten by the Kohanim, and part of it is eaten by the person who brought the Karban, by the regular Yisrael who brought the Karban. Whenever there is any kind of offering that ends up being eaten by people, part of it is burned. So, another example. Let's say you have a Karban Todah, a Thanksgiving offering. So in addition to the animal that's brought, there's also 40 loaves that are brought. Those 40 loaves are eaten by the people. But first, four of them are burned. Four of them are taken off and burned. So it's not... There's always a portion that's taken off and given to the Mizbeach. When a person brings in a mincha, a meal offering, that meal offering is eaten by the Kohen. But first, a kmitza is taken off. A handful is taken off and is burned. A handful of the flour is taken off and burned. So there's always something that is burned from the item. The lechem hapanim, the showbread, none of it is burned. It's 12 loaves every week that are arranged on the table. None of it is burned.
How big are they?
What's that?
How big are they?
They're fairly large.
Yeah.
They're fairly large. None of it is burned. So then what is burned? You can't have anything that isn't burned at all. So on the table, on the shulchan, in addition to the bread, there are two bazichen. There are two containers, two bowls of levona, of spices. And those spices are burned. The levona is burned. So they're burned, but the bread is completely eaten. So what David says to Achimelech is that because we're dealing with lechem hapanim, that the levona, the spices, were already burned, therefore the bread is now permitted to be eaten, and therefore the bread is almost like it's chol. It's almost like it's not sanctified anymore. Now why is it almost like it's not sanctified anymore? Because we have a law that sanctified animals, bread, money, in the Beis HaMikdash, if they are misused, if someone uses them for his own benefit, that is called mi'ila. Mi'ila is to use an item of the Beis HaMikdash for one's own use. And that is prohibited. And if one does that, if one does mi'ila, then they have to atone with a sacrifice. So the showbread, the lechem hapanim, as long as they're sitting on the table, and the lavona, the spices have not been burned yet, they are subject to mi'ila. If someone would use them for his own purposes, that would be the misuse of sanctified items, and one would have to atone with a mi'ila. But once the lavona is burned, then the bread is no longer subject to mi'ila. So David is saying to the Kohen, it's true that you only have sanctified bread, but the sanctified bread that you have is not as sanctified as it was a few minutes ago, because you offer the burning of the lavona. You burn the incense, the spices already, and therefore the bread has actually come down a notch. That's first of all. Second of all, even if this was the day that it became sanctified in the utensil, which means this is the day that it was baked, which means it is subject to mi'ila, it is as sanctified as it can get, I would still take it. Because since I am in danger of dying, I'm in a sakanas nafashas, it's pikuach nafashas, it's a life and death situation. So for a life and death situation, this is not idolatry, this is not immorality, this is not murder, and therefore I am allowed to eat the bread to save my life. So he's saying to him, even if it would be at its most sanctified point, I would still ask you for the bread. Yeah.
Are there certain days which they would burn the spices? Yeah, so that's how he knew?
Yeah.
Or?
Yeah. It was the bread was switched. It was changed. The bread was it was baked on Friday, and then the new bread was put in on Shabbos.
On Shabbos?
Yeah, on Shabbos. And the old bread was removed on Shabbos. And then that new bread would stay there till the next week, till the next Shabbos. And that was one of the miracles that happened with the bread, which actually we're going to see very shortly, that even though it was 8 days later, it was baked on Friday and it wasn't eaten until the following Shabbos, it was still just as fresh as when it was put in on Friday, on 8 days previously. So that's when it was normally done. Now that would seem to suggest that this happens on Shabbos.
So the spices are offered on Shabbos?
I'm trying, as you asked that question, I was trying to remember whether they're offered on Shabbos or whether they are offered on Saturday night. I don't remember. I think that they are burned. I don't even want to say. I'm not sure. Okay. I don't remember.
That was never less than without bread on it. There was never more.
Correct.
For a second.
Correct. Correct. There is a machlokas. There's a difference of opinion whether it could be a second without it. There's a difference of opinion whether you removed one and then put another one in, or whether that as you're removing one, the other one is going in. It's a difference of opinion. But it certainly wasn't a long period of time that there wasn't bread there. That's correct. Okay. So he needs this bread because he will die if he doesn't have the bread. Vayitem lo hakoin kodesh. So the coin gave him the sanctified bread. Ki lo hayasham lechem. Because there was no other bread there. Ki im lechem aponim. Only the lechem aponim, only the showbread. Hamusar milifnei Hashem, that were removed from before Hashem. So the Navi makes it clear to us, he wouldn't have given him the lechem aponim if it wasn't for the fact that that's all there was. There was nothing else. And therefore he gave it to him. So that was removal for Hashem, lasum lechem chom, to put hot bread, biyom hilakho, on the day that it's taken. The Gemara tells us what this means is that the bread was put in hot, and it would remain hot until the day it was taken. So it was the miracle of the lechem apanim. The Navi is being a little bit wordy over here about the lechem apanim that David HaMelech is about to eat. So clearly, it's not just coincidental that all there was the lechem apanim. And this is one of the things we're going to have to understand, is what is being emphasized here, that David is the one who eats of the lechem apanim, which has the miracle that it is always fresh. Yeah.
Doesn't the coin don't have a home? Come to my house? Or he made me something to eat?
David made it. His presentation to Achimelech was, I don't have time. I'm on the way to do something for the king. He didn't have time to hang around. So he gets this bread. Then the Navi tells us a very critical point. Visham ish me'av de Shaul bayomahu. And there was a man from the servants of Shaul on that day. Netzar lifnei Hashem, who was
detained.
Is that what it says there?
Yeah, detained.
Okay, in front of Hashem. This is a voluntary detention. It's not that he was put there. Ushmo Doeg HaAdomi, his name was Doeg HaAdomi, Abir HaRoim Asher LeShaul, and he was of the great ones for Shaul. He was the Av Bezdin, he was the head of the court of the Sanhedrin, was Doeg HaAdomi. The Gemara tells us, what does it mean that he was Netzar Lifnei Hashem? He was detained in front of Hashem. He was there to study a great deal of Torah. He was there, he had sequestered himself in this holy place to study Torah. He had wanted to get away from everything and just focus on the study of Torah. That's what Doeg is doing over there in Nov. But of course, because he's there, he sees everything that happens. And that is going to be the undoing of Nov. Vayomer David laAchimelech, David said to Achimelech, V'in yesh po tachas yodcha chanis ocharev, is there here under your hands a small sword or a large sword? Ki gam charbi v'gam kelai lo lakachti v'yadi, because also my sword and my utensils I didn't take with me. Ki hayad var melech nachutz, because the king's word was urgent. I had to run. I didn't have a chance even to grab my sword on my way out the door. Vayomer HaKohen, so the Kohen said, Cherev Goliath HaPlishti asher hikitsa be'emek ha'elah, the sword of Goliath the Plishti that you struck in the valley of Elah, hinehi luta basimla, it is wrapped in the garment, acharei ha'efod, behind the ephod. Now that's a funny statement. The ephod is the apron that the Kohen Gadol wears. So what does it mean it's behind the ephod? If you want to take that, kach, take it. Because there is no other sword here but it. By Omer David, David said, Ein kamoa, there's no sword like it. Tenen ali, give it to me. By Yaakov David, by Yivrach, by Omahu, David got up and he ran away on that day. He played Shaul from before Shaul. By Yavo el Achish Melech Gath, and he came to Achish, the king of Gath, which is in the Plishtim. He was running out of the country. The Gemara tells us that when it says it was behind the ephod, what that means is that Achimelech was reluctant to give the sword to David. He didn't want to give the sword to David before he asked permission of Hashem. And he asked the Urim V'Tumim, he asked the breastplate of the Kohen Gadol, that's what it means behind the ephod, and Hashem responded, you should give it to him. And he did. And then David runs away to Achish, the king of Gath, who is of the Plishtim. Now, we need to understand why he runs to Achish, the king of Gath. What does David think is going to happen over there? As we're about to see, he's actually going to be in great danger over there. But evidently, David thinks he'll be protected over there. So we have to understand why that is. I'm going to keep reading. We have a lot of things a lot of loose ends to cover, which we're going to have to discuss again next time. But I want to finish this parak, at least the first time around. Vayomru avde achin shelav, the servants of Achish said to him, Halo zed David melech haaretz. This is David, the king of the land. Notice they call him king. They call him king of the land. They don't mean that he's the official king of Israel, but they mean that he's a very powerful force. That this is the one they say about him in the circles, in the dancing, saying, the girls say, Shaul struck down his thousands and David his 10,000s. Remember the mistake that Shaul made? He thought that they were praising David more than Shaul. And here they repeat this line. Evidently it was a very well-known line in the Jewish people. It was all over the headlines. And the people of Achish knew this. David put these things, he took these things to heart. He was very scared because of the king of Achish, the king of Gass. Now he thought his life might be in danger. They might want to kill him as revenge or as a way of getting rid of him. So he changed his
demeanor,
thank you, in their eyes. Vayis holeo biyadam. And he
feigned himself.
Okay, in front of them. Yeah, he acted funny.
What's
that?
Crazy.
Right. He wrote on the doors of the gate. And he allowed his saliva to drip down his beard, meaning he wanted to give the impression that he was insane. Achish said to his servants, Hine siru ish mishtageya. Here you see a man who is insane. Lama tavyu osoilai. Why'd you bring him to me? Chasar mishuga imani. Do I lack crazy people? Do I lack insanity? Ki aveisem es zeh mishtageya aloi, that you brought him to be insane with me? Hazeh yabo abesi. Will this one come to my house? My father-in-law, who is a principal of a day school, has so he has up a sign not in school but at home. He has a sign up that says Chasar Meshuga Imani. Do I lie? He's not referring to the students, nor is he referring to his faculty. Okay. Now, let's review what we need to understand over here. There are many, many things that are very unclear that have to be understood. So David now is going to run away from there. He's going to get away. So the overall issue of him going to Nov, because he believes that Nov will be a place where he can successfully be helped without hurting the people of Nov, which is a mistake. The people of Nov are going to be hurt drastically. He needs food. Now, his plan is to run to the Plishtim. Why is he running to the Plishtim? So it must be he's interpreted that when Hashem gave him a sign that he must run away, where do you run? Anywhere you go in Israel, you could be tracked down. David therefore presumed that Hashem wants him to run out of the country. And therefore he goes to Achish. Now, there are other places he could have gone out of the country. Why does he pick Achish, the king of Gath? That's a question which perhaps we'll be able to answer. But that's a question of itself. Why go there? He asks for food. We have a whole discussion with a lot of detail that the food that he got was the lechem hapanim, was the showbread. That needs to be understood. Why? Doeg Hadomi just so happens to be there at that time. That can't be coincidental. What is Doeg? Why does Doeg at this moment in time decide that he needs to absolutely focus on the study of Torah, to go to the holiest place and bury himself in the study of Torah without any distractions? Why does he choose that now of all times? And because he chooses to be there at this time, and David comes there, there's a confluence of events that he witnesses David getting the lechem upon him. Now we know what Doeg is going to end up doing is telling Lashon Hara to Shaul, and that's going to cause Shaul to command Doeg to kill all the Kohanim of Nov. And that's what's going to happen. Doeg is going to lose his portion in the world to come because of this. it can't be that it was a bad thing that Doeg went to study Torah. That can't be. It's a mitzvah to study Torah. And Doeg was of the greatest Talmidei Chachamim. It can't be that it was a bad thing. There must have been a good reason for him to come to study Torah at this time. And if Hashem arranged things that Doeg would be there and David would be there at the same time, apparently this was an opportunity for Doeg to earn his place in the world to come in a big way. Every Jew has one to begin with. But Doeg was here on the cusp, apparently, of great things. But instead, he reacts incorrectly, improperly, and instead causes Lashon Hara to kill out the city of Nov and loses his portion of the world to come. But there was a different thing that should have happened. There was another plan which could have and should have happened but didn't. What is it? Doeg is introduced after we hear about the Lechem HaPanim. That seems to be the point that he's introduced. The next thing that happens is the Sword of Goliath. The Sword of Goliath also is curious. Why doesn't he want to give it to him? Why does he have to ask Hashem permission to give it to David? What's so special about the Sword of Goliath? There's something about that. Doeg is introduced between these two things, which means that Doeg's jealousy of David was aroused because of one of them. Either because of the point that was made prior to his introduction, which is the Lechem HaPanim, or the point that was made after his introduction, which is the Sword of Goliath. But it's one of those two things that he's introduced. And the role he could have played would have been different. There was something important going on over here. And then David goes to Achish and immediately realizes that he's in grave danger and gets out by acting insane. So we have to therefore understand this, the greater plan over here, what could have happened in the city of Nov with David and Doeg, what goes wrong, what's this focus on the Lechem HaPanim, on the showbread, what's the focus on Goliath, on his sword. And then, Achish, I'm not sure if we'll be able to answer this last one, about Achish, why does David go specifically to Achish, the king of Gath, rather than to any of the other countries that surround Eretz Yisrael? These are the loose ends which we're going to have to cover in detail next time. Yeah?
Is there a Tehillim that's specifically about his going through this? Mm-hmm. Which Tehillim are they?
There's on Shabbos morning, B'shanoso es tamo lifnei Avimelech, when David changed his demeanor in front of Avimelech. Calls him Avimelech instead of Achish. Avimelech is always the name. That's like Paro. That's the name of the plish, of the head of the plish, of the plishtim. So there you have. That's where you have the famous pasuk of Mi ha'ish ha'chafetz chayim ohi b'amun li'os tov the son of lashon chaymer, not to speak lashon hara. It's all in there, which we'll touch on as well.
What
character
is that?
34. With David Bishanosa is Tamal Samelch. 34.
For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. He does not make money off the site, but he does need money in order to run the site. Those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.